You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Julian McMillan. Julian, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Brainerd.
Julian, of course, we're going to talk about your show at The Hole in New York City, Birdbath. I'm really looking forward to jumping into this. And, you know, there's different elements in the show. Of course, there's sculptures, there's paintings, but Birdbath itself seems kind of humorous. It's a kind of humorous title. It maybe seems sort of spring-oriented. Can you tell me a little bit about just the title of the show?
Yeah, the title is humorous. And I was thinking about a way to kind of structure the show, and as I was, you know, thinking about what the title should be or what should be in the work, and I had kind of two bodies of work that are really interconnected but are a series of paintings that have to do with the surface of the water and then a series of bird sculptures or decoys, and so I wanted a way to connect those and an actual physical bird bath, I thought would be sort of a fun, like almost like a pun maybe on just the water works, and then there's the bird works, and I just realized that a bird bath combines them. And then I had this idea of having a water feature in an exhibition for a while, and I realized that this was the moment.
That's cool. So tell me about your relationship to birds and water. I mean, is that something to do with where you grew up or where you live? That feels not like New York City.
No, it's not New York City. I do come from a sort of, I guess you'd say, a family of people who are into birds. My mom is a bit of a bird watcher. Her parents were big bird watchers, and during COVID, I was spending some time with my aunt and uncle, and with extended family, and I came across my grandparents' bird book, and it had written down, or sort of, you know, annotated rather, all of the birds that my grandparents had seen in their travels in the U.S. And I found that to be really interesting and inspiring. And so my brother and I, who were together in COVID in Vermont, spent a lot of time outside looking for birds. My brother died in 2022. And so dealing with his loss and I think loss in general, I think that the way birds, at least in my family, like the appearance of birds in our lives, they often seem to signify people that we've lost. So there's a way to kind of meditate on that as well.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. And my condolences for your brother. I can't imagine how difficult that is. I mean, I can imagine a little bit. I also lost a brother, but it was quite a while ago, but still that never, ever leaves you. And so that's,
yeah,
that's
so sorry
very,
to hear that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's it's a wound that never heals, really, right? But that idea of the birds then takes on a different feeling then, right? Birds as almost like the way those cranes are made, right? To I don't know exactly that about that whole ritual, but birds as metaphors or even direct kind of connections to another world. Right. To something, maybe spiritual isn't quite the right word, but so when you and your brother were spending all that time bird watching in the pandemic too, you know, that was such a special and kind of bizarre time. that sounds like something very, very unusual happened there, right? Because you were also tuned to a world that we're never normally tuned to, not only because it was the pandemic, but because you were it was the pandemic, and you were in this unusual area, right? I mean, that was a kind of whole separate
absolutely.
reality, it sounds like.
I think so. And I think all of us were kind of like resensitized in different ways, and you know, we're able to see things a little differently, or had the time, you know, and space to spend time doing different things. I guess something else that was kind of interesting about that time was that I was still in grad school. I was still in art school when the pandemic started. So I was, when I went up to Vermont, part of the reason was that, you know, I had to finish my thesis work basically. And my uncle has a shop up there in his barn. And basically I was able to use that to, I was able to use this kind of garage barn indoor outdoor space to finish a bunch of my work. So I really connected with that time is also the idea of like the studio being all, you know, from an indoor sort of art school white cube institutional space immediately became this indoor outdoor garage weather, you know, there's a lake nearby. Like it changed the kind of context really quickly, in addition to all of the shifts that were happening in the world. So I think of those being sort of all together, changing my work really radically.
Yeah, so,
you know, I think that the decoys in particular, you know, I came across a bunch of them when I was up there, and they're these carved bird sculptures which are used typically for hunting, or at least theoretically for hunting. I think a lot of them are just decorative. But the idea of, you know, this kind of like incredibly lovingly carved tool, which is sort of supposed to kind of coax nature closer to you, which then leads to this darker, you know, possibly more sinister potential of death. It also felt appropriate. It's something about the kind of mimicry that a lot of them employ. You know, I mean, the ones that I make aren't really trying to mimic the way, you know, the way the plumage of a loon or something, but they are really lovingly painted. And anyways, they have this kind of potential that I find can lead in a bunch of different ways, which I really like.
I like that too. And let's talk about the paintings in the show. Let's begin with one of them. Surface Tension. This is a landscape, right? What's happening here? This is a landscape. Is this also from Vermont in that time?
It is. That's from where that painting was started. I'd say about a year ago, when I spent a few weeks up there in Vermont with family, and I did something that I don't usually do, which is I brought some small canvases and tried to actually set up an easel essentially and paint from the landscape, which I realized that I just really can't do. It was a really bad experience, but
it's a nice idea. That's like the classic, you know, artist playing painter, right?
Yeah,
so romantic.
Exactly. It sounded so beautiful, you know, August in Vermont, and I was really going to do it, and I really can't do it, or I don't have the interest in it, I guess. I don't know, something about standing there and trying to paint what's in front of you, the landscape in particular. Like, I've always enjoyed figure drawing, but I just couldn't really do it. But anyway, so I had these three or four kind of disastrous canvases that I brought back to the studio. But what did make an impression was standing right at the edge of a lake and trying to paint the surface of the water, and the kind of constantly moving surface and the way that especially when you're standing right above it, you can both see through, and it kind of acts as a magnifying glass for things underneath, and then also acts as, I guess, a mirror at the same time. It's reflecting light, and it's also, you're able to see through it at the same time. And that's a really difficult thing to try to paint, but it became a kind of, in that painting, it became the challenge of like, how can I express both what's underneath and what's reflecting on top at the same time?
Yeah, I like that. I like that so much. And the other, there's another painting in here called Tomb Painting, which of course is quite different. And seems like there's a lot of references in here. There's a narrative in here, right? There's an enormous amount of things happening. There's what looks like feet, kind of somebody dead perhaps, but there's so many other elements in here. This really feels like a story. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, that one is tomb painting is it started as a kind of charcoal drawing on canvas, and I was really attracted to the incredibly matte surface of charcoal on canvas, and it reminded me of like fresco, and the way that, you know, fresco painting gets, you know, the pigment just gets sucked into the plaster and appears totally matte and chalky. There's a really one of my favorite paintings of all time is this Etruscan or Greek, or I'm not exactly sure on the exact timing there, but it's a tomb painting from that era in Greece or Italy, or, you know, I think they may have been the same thing at one point. It's called Tomb of the Diver, and it's this really enigmatic tomb painting. It's just this young boy sort of leaping off of a rock, and he's kind of poised between up in the air above the water, you know. And I think the idea is that he's sort of poised between two worlds, between, you know, our world, and the afterlife, and the sort of unknown. And that painting, tomb painting, was a kind of way of reimagining that scenario. And I think in general, the whole body of work, or, you know, a lot of the paintings in that, in the show, use the surface of the water in that narrative way, like basically imagining the surface of the water. I guess the conceit would be the surface of the water is this kind of membrane between, you know, our world and some kind of underworld or afterlife, or just something that we don't totally understand.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so that's not unlike a theme that's running throughout the show, right? Which, I mean, if I'm not overstating it, is also about death, right? About this liminal state, like what is death? What happened, kind of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think all of my work is on some level dealing with that question. You know, I mentioned my brother, so it's been very on my mind in the last few years. But I, you know, I think even before that, I sort of think of all of art making as in some way a kind of funerary act.
Well, death is also a total mystery. I mean, you know, my brother died when I was much younger, but I would constantly ask my mother, to her great distress, but what happened? How did he drown? Couldn't they take the water out? What does it mean that he died? You know, and you're constantly trying to understand it, and, you know, it's impossible to explain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's right. It's just, I remember even coming up with solutions for my mother. My mother's like, no, that's not it. I can't explain it. I don't know. And I'd say, well, can you say it's like somebody's like wound up like a toy, and then they wind down. They're gonna wind up. She's like, no, that's not it either. You know, that there's something about death that's like almost unsayable, right? It's we can't grasp it, it seems. almost.
I think so. And I think, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about your brother. And
yes.
And the fact that he drowned does feel related to what we're talking about somehow. But, you know, I was with my brother the moment that he passed, and, you know, the experience of watching him, you know, be alive and then not, it really was a kind of, you know, as close to a supernatural, I'd say, experience as ever I'll get, you know. I like you say, I don't understand it, and I don't think any of us can.
yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about one more, Regretful Decoy. I just love the title of it. There's several decoys in here, one with a bath and a couple of things happening. But Regretful Decoy, I don't know if that's just a play on words, but I kind of love the way that sounds and has a, an interesting tone to it. It almost sounds like it addresses the hunting aspect of what a decoy is supposed to be. It gives decoy agency almost, but I'm reading into it as well.
I think I liked that it's a little unclear. I think as I made more decoys, you know, a lot of them are in that kind of classic bird sitting on the water kind of silhouette pose, let's call it. You know, if you look out onto a pond and you see a duck just floating, that's the kind of classic pose, let's say, of a decoy. And then as I kept making them, I sort of got more interested in the weird ways that birds can articulate their necks, especially, you know, if you think of a swan or a goose or a loon, the ability they have to kind of articulate their necks and move them around in these really beautiful, elegant ways. And I was trying to do that and trying to carve wood into these shapes. And that was a challenge that I really enjoyed. Anyway, so I made one that was kind of looking down and backwards and in what I initially imagined to be a sort of protective or kind of like self-protective pose. And then once I had carved it and I, you know, I saw it was always kind of looking backwards at me in the studio, I found, and I don't know, regret. It made me think of regret more than it made me think of protection somehow. There's another one that is called Reflective Decoy in the show, which is kind of a decoy that is also, you know, its own reflection is built also in wood. And anyways, I thought that Regretful and Reflective were a nice pair.
Yeah, I like the sound of both of those. So of course, for listeners here, you can follow the links to see more images and learn more about the show. I want to ask you one more off topic question before we go. What are you reading at the moment?
So I have been reading, I've been reading, honestly, I have a sort of backlog of copies of the London Review of Books, which I'm just kind of slogging through. Right now I have a almost 1-year-old son, and so doing a lot of really early mornings with him. And
well, so you're reading board books too.
Yeah, exactly. Reading a lot of board books and bath books and stuff. And then, you know, I find that LRB has a really nice variety, and the articles, you know, it's sort of the right length for me to kind of blog through when I'm being interrupted by a baby who's crawling around a lot. And, you know, there's enough art criticism, there's enough about literature, there's enough about politics that I'm enjoying just working through my stack of LRBs right now.
Right. Well, I guess it's actually not the age for board books with him, is it? Is 1 year old?
Well, we have a lot of them. I mean, the board books are great because he can't destroy them, you know? Like he is young for reading. You know, he's just starting to be able to kind of sit and focus on a book. Usually what we do is we have to give him one for him to hold and kind of bang around, and then we'll read one to him. But he's getting there. And yeah, the board books are good because you can't rip the pages out.
Huh. That's good to hear. Well, I wish you well with your son, and thanks so much for talking to me about this today. Again, for listeners, there's links to follow through and learn more. Again, Julian, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you, Brainerd. I appreciated this.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.